Supreme Court is reconvened. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Nicholas presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, go ahead and have a seat. Do we have the Maranatha Baptist Academy here today? Would you please stand up? I'd like to say hello.
Oh, good group.
Really good group. I've been to your beautiful place over there in Jefferson County. It's a wonderful place to visit. So anyone who hasn't visited there might like to do so. You have a beautiful environment to think in. So good morning. After this next oral argument, Justice Rebecca Dallet is available to meet with you should you like to meet with her and ask her any questions. She can't talk about cases that we're hearing, but she can answer pretty much anything else you would like to ask her. Anyone who wants to stick around is welcome to do so.
We get all kinds of questions.
I know. That's good. That's good. Challenger. She could use that. She likes that. That's why she does this job. She's very good at it. So, thank you for coming, and it's nice to see you today. I'm glad you have a good travel day. Have a seat. The next order of business is, case sheet, Sauk County versus SAM 19AP 1033. Could I have counsel's appearances, please? Right. Good morning to everyone. The lineup's 20 minutes, 5 minutes, 30 minutes, 5 minutes, right? Okay. All right, let's proceed this morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth Rich, appearing on behalf of the petitioner SAM. The briefs refer to him by his initials, but if there's no objection, I'll call him Sam today. It's not his real name. Mootness in Chapter 51 cases has become a pressing problem in Wisconsin. We all agree that involuntary civil commitment represents a massive curtailment of liberty. Yet Wisconsin appellate courts continue to dismiss as moot appeals of commitments that have expired before decisions are rendered. If that's a correct application of the mootness doctrine, then based on the letter we all received from Chief Judge Neubauer, that means that 100% of initial commitments would have expired before their appeals could be heard. It's a startling statistic to me. And between 60 and 80% of recommitments would have expired before the appeals could be heard. At the time the letter was written, we didn't know about that last 20%. But based on my experience, I'd expect it to be close to 80%. These appellants will be denied their constitutional and statutory right to appeal their involuntary commitments, all due to application of a doctrine of judicial economy, which I'd submit has not proven to be very economic. We are litigating mootness on almost every case, almost every involuntary commitment case, and it takes a great deal of resources from the county, from defense counsel, and from the courts.
No, the problem is a timing problem for getting it into the Court of Appeals and getting a decision for clients like yours. And that problem comes from the 6-month commitment. We have problems sometimes with 1-year commitments too, but 6 months are really hard to move things forward. Would it be helpful, do you think, if the court would ask someone to file a rules petition that would require the Court of Appeals to hear the appeal and issue a decision within a certain number of days?
I think that's one possible solution. To me, an interesting analogy to Wisconsin's situation is Alaska. The Naomi B. case is cited in the brief. Alaska was at a very similar point to where we are in 2019. So they started out saying, as we did an expired appeal is moot. They moved from that to say, well, maybe some of the mootness exceptions could apply, which is what we did.
That gets more complicated, though.
Well, then they said, okay, let's try to set up a procedural safeguard, which is what we're kind of talking about today.
Yeah.
And what they decided on was make the county file a motion if they intend to assert mootness, and then litigate that before you get to the merits. Turned out to be completely unworkable, just more litigation over mootness. So, you know, there's potential. I certainly don't want to advocate for longer than 6 months. This case, Sam's case, was one of the rare, according to Judge Neubauer's letter, 4 out of 80 that had a less than 12-month recommitment period. And then this was when the public defender was still paying $40 an hour, so they couldn't find an attorney for 4 months. That's somewhat better now. Still a backlog. Then the transcripts, 60 days. So by the time the transcripts were filed, this was already expired. And it's going to be hard to fix that.
You know, that's possible, except that it is also possible that the recording of the proceeding could be done by a mechanism that it wouldn't take 60 days for you all to get a transcript. And we're capable of directing the courts, yes, when you have this kind of a proceeding, you have to take the transcript by a different method. I think we have to look at all the potential players in the problem for making this come too late for clients like yours to have a decision on the merits, which is what we would all like.
I agree, Justice Rogenczak, and I think my colleague from the Public Defender's Office is probably better to address some of those nuts and bolts issues because she has more familiarity than I do with how that all comes together.
Okay. Thank you.
Mootness is a judicial policy, so it's something the court has applied because the court has declared it to be so. So I'm a little bit concerned about some of the suggestions made that we could invoke our superintending authority to make or make a rule if a petition were brought to us. What if we simply revise our judicial policy so that in situations like your clients, and there are a number of them that have come to us over the last few years, what if we revise our judicial policy so that when there are procedural delays that are in no way attributable to the subject matter of the proceeding, as in your client's case, that we just simply will not apply mootness doctrine, and then the Court of Appeals won't apply mootness doctrine. What do you think about that?
I liked everything except I'm not sure I understand the qualifier. So in what cases would you apply mootness under that doctrine?
I don't know. But there, I guess what I'm saying is I wouldn't want to, and I'm dangerously thinking aloud right now, I wouldn't want to foreclose an argument that could be made that mootness should be applied to a particular person because of something in the process that's not attributable to the state. The delays in your client's case seem to be all attributable to the government. I'll use that as a broad umbrella. So I wouldn't want to foreclose it as an argument that could be made in certain cases, but it would, I think, if we revised our policy in this regard, it would allow meaningful appeals to proceed without mootness having to be litigated when it's clear, as this record is quite clear, that it was delays attributable to the government, not to anything that your client did or didn't do.
Certainly, in principle, I think that sounds more workable than what we have. And there may be, I tried to think of some of the examples. I've had a long time to think about this particular case. So I tried to think of some examples, and it was hard to come up with because I am a big advocate of the collateral consequence theory in Sibrin and DK.
And so related to that theory, can you talk to us a little bit about the cost of care? Under 4610 sub 2, and how that statute, even if it's not being applied at this point in time, like costs are not being sought, how that still is, as you argued, a collateral consequence.
Yes. So It actually, I believe it works two ways. So one way it works is in the Jankowski case, which was 1981, so it's been a while. But in 1981, Milwaukee decided to bring a class action against 435 people and claim that each of them owed $6,000 to $7,000 for their involuntary commitments. And the court was pretty definite about not approving of that. And the court said, so you're going to force them to pay for the care, they put it in quotes, they received involuntarily. And they said, no, you can't do that. But the statute still says, as you discussed in other oral arguments, it still says that they shall assess. They don't. And the question came up at another oral argument about how long do they have. I could not find the answer to that directly, but indirectly I think they that most government actions have 6 years unless something else is specified.
So six.
So they would have 6 years to bring the action, and then if they went through and got a judgment, they have 20 years, potentially a lifetime, because they can renew that judgment every 20 years. So even though it's not the practice, perhaps, of most counties to do it, it has been done by counties in the past, and it is a liability that could hang over their heads for quite a long time. The other thing is, when someone is committed involuntarily and unconstitutionally and unlawfully, they've got some losses. I haven't done this yet, but I'm thinking about it. They've probably lost their apartment. They've lost their possessions, which were put out on the street. They've lost their pets. They might have lost their children. Those are big damages. And so I think that's another potential financial consequence for somebody who's who loses their right to appeal and perhaps establish that the commitment was unlawful.
And Richard, I just want to that Justice Rebecca Bradley was talking to you about, and that is the possibility of us revising our judicial policy so that when there are procedural delays, we would not apply a mootness doctrine. Does that solve the whole issue here, though? Because if things aren't moving quickly enough for an individual, I get that you could still bring a claim, but like in this case for Sam, if things aren't expedited, it doesn't make any difference for an individual client. So would we need to do more than just apply mootness differently in these cases?
I agree. Well, as I said in my brief, not that there's anything this court can do about it, perhaps, but the elephant in the room is I think we commit too many people, more than most other states, more than any other state. So one way that this court, I think, successfully addressed that problem was in DJW, because in the few years that I've been doing these cases, sometimes the transcripts I would get were 10 pages long. There's no meaningful hearing, no meaningful analysis of whether a person was actually dangerous. And I think this court sent a message in GJW that we got to do better than that. And that's why I'm asking from a due process perspective and to address this practical problem, the county identify in its petition what standard of dangerousness, in addition to the recommitment standard, is being sought.
Counsel, courts of appeal have applied a sort of harmless error to some parts of DJW at least. And I just want to know your thoughts on that. And again, let's consider a scenario, for example, where everyone sort of understands what the standard of dangerous is, it's just not stated, or that it's clear from the record that a particular standard of dangerousness was being argued and is clearly satisfied, just for the purposes of my hypothetical, I'm not talking about your client here. Would you still argue that that should be reversed in that circumstance under DJW, or how would you approach that?
Oh, I feel very strongly, Your Honor, that all of the elements of the dangerous standard in question were not established, then that's not good enough.
No. I'm sorry. I may not have asked my question clearly. I apologize. Let's assume it's clear all the standards for a particular dangerousness element, okay, are clear from the record and have been established without question in my hypothetical, okay?
Okay.
But the trial court does not specifically enumerate that standard. Would you say in that circumstance that should still be reversed? Because some courts of appeals, in unpublished cases I've read, have applied a form of harmless error to that kind of error. There's multiple kinds of things that DGW talks about. DGW talks about making factual findings. DGW talks about identifying the legal grounds. And I joined that opinion. But the Court of Appeals has said there might be some circumstances where it's clear there's no legal error and dangerousness is clearly established. There we go. We're going to answer the question on those grounds. How would you respond to that?
My first response is, having handled 60 of these in the last 3 years, I've never seen it. My second response is that we tend to cut corners. So, and Sam's case is a good example. You know, the judges just accept what the doctors are testifying, and there's a couple of them that are notorious for cutting corners. So here's with Sam. He was, on his initial commitment, he was running away from his dad, who was threatening to take him to the hospital. He ran into the woods. He was crying, sobbing, and when they finally picked him up, he had some small superficial lacerations on his face and chest. He was cutting himself. I don't think that comes anywhere close to the first standard of dangerousness. You know, imminent threat of substantial bodily harm or death? No. He was making little cuts, cry for help, cry for attention. But that we do that routinely, and so I think what DJW did was make, and the judges actually have seminars on this. They've told me about it. We better learn how to do this right because we're getting reversed. I think that's a good thing. I think it's good that they're taking it seriously and they're trying to do better.
That may be so, but in my scenario, I'm assuming that dangerousness was satisfied by the record. So my question to you is, again, some courts have done a harmless error kind of approach and said, listen, trial court should have dotted their I's and crossed their T's. And DJW told them to do that. They didn't quite do that. However, it's clear under the record that dangerousness has been established. And any error on that point was harmless. So your point is an important one. It's a good one. It's why the court and DJW said what they said. And I joined that. I'm talking about a scenario where it is clearly established. Because what we're talking about also is just policy moving forward and thinking about different kinds of ways DJW may or may not be satisfied and how we or the Court of Appeals should handle those kinds of cases.
Yeah, I understand that. I just don't – I see it devolving into what I saw when I first started handling these cases, rubber stamps, frankly. I want to see the I's dotted and the T's crossed in these cases, at least until we get a lot better at it.
What's your best argument for why there should be notice given to the person who's to the county's trying to commit ahead of time as to which standard the county's going to proceed under? Because the county argues, well, this is burdensome, this is they have all kinds of arguments against that, but what's your best argument for why that's important and why it isn't burdensome?
It's important because of due process, because the attorney and the client need to have a reasonable opportunity to prepare for defense and to know what they're defending. The five standards of dangerousness are very different. So in Sam's case, if I had known they were proceeding under the third standard, say, which has come up in the briefing, I would have this is the practical part of it. I would have called different witnesses. I would have prepared differently. I would have taken steps to prove that second big element of the third standard was not met, which is there's no availability in the community for him to be cared for, and he wouldn't avail himself of it if there were. But he was living before his commitment. He was living independently. He receives disability benefits that are enough for him to live on with his subsidized housing. He has, in the police reports, in the social worker reports, his dad and his grandmother have cared for him and supported him and helped him. So there was nothing about that in the record. And if you're going to establish the third standard, I think it has to be. And I don't think it's burdensome because the county is filing a petition. No, it's I might make some concessions if it were an emergency detention, but even then, if you're going to confine somebody, even for 72 hours, you'd better have a reason, and you better have some support for it. So put that in your document. I'm not going to say that that can't change if the evidence supports it.
Could they allege multiple if they want to proceed potentially under two different standards? Could they give that notice and that would be sufficient?
Yeah. All five is no fair.
Not well, fair means due process.
Right. Would that be the danger that they're just going to... That you bring up a good point. If we say that they need to allege it, are they just going to say all five just to be safe?
Yeah. That, no. And on the recommitment, it's even more important and less burdensome to the county because there, now they've had the person in their custody for 6 to 12 months, and this is pointed out in, the public defender's brief. They've had custody for 6 to 12 months. They should know by now, you know, what are the issues here? Why are we keeping this person under commitment? And just tell me so that I can defend properly.
And you don't know because the attorneys don't get appointed until shortly before the hearing.
Well, I always review all the medical records and all the DHS records, but I had a recent hearing where, the doctor said third and fourth, and another doctor said first, and then at in closing arguments for the first time, counsel said fifth. And that's frustrating, because I had no opportunity to respond to that. And it happens all the time. So that's the practical problem. I haven't talked a lot about mootness. I know the court has talked a lot about it in other arguments, but I do think I didn't argue in my I discussed the exceptions to mootness in my policy discussion of the brief, but in my brief in chief talking about Sam's situation, I argued collateral consequences, and I have the author of the opinion here, so she could correct me if I'm interpreting DK incorrectly. But what I see is the controlling case is Sibrin v. New York. That case, and DK referenced that case too when it was talking about collateral consequences. And I think that's the proper underpinning for a decision that the case is not moot. The firearms ban that's a point that needs some, I think, clarification from the court because I've gotten different rulings from the Second Circuit and the Fourth Circuit on whether DK applies to a recommitment. I say it does. And I've handled, in December, I handled a petition for reinstatement of gun rights. And the first thing that the county argued was, this was an initial commitment, but she had previous hospitalizations for self-harm, suicide attempts. And the first thing the county said was, no, based on that record, you shouldn't reinstate. She might have done fine for the last year, but we have no idea, you know, if she's going to relapse, as she has in the past. So I do think that it's very important for when you're going in on that petition for restoration of gun rights that that you don't have commitment after commitment piled up.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court, Attorney Colleen Ball appearing on behalf of the State Public Defender. I would like to touch on mootness and due process. Members of the court, our clients who appeal their commitment orders feel deeply violated. They've been told they're mentally ill and dangerous. They've been told that their perception of reality is wrong, that they can't make decisions for themselves. The government has seized control of their lives. They've ordered them to take medication they don't want that carries a risk of side effects that none of us here would accept. And we all know, I think all of us here agree, they have the statutory and constitutional right to appeal those decisions. But it is in the name of judicial economy that they are not getting decisions on the merits. And one of the really insidious consequences of that is that the trial judges and trial lawyers, both sides, are not being told when they've made mistakes, and then the errors recur. So we don't get decisions on the merits, and that's often even when we raise constitutional issues or recurring issues. And so we, the public defender, for the sake of our clients and for the sake of public confidence in the mental health justice system, we ask the court to step in and address this problem. And the first thing we would like is the very one that Justice Rogan-Sack suggested, and which Corp Counsel, I believe, agrees with, that the matter should be referred for rulemaking. This court has the ability to do that, and we have special rules for all kinds of appeals, and this one seems like it's a perfect candidate for that. But in the interim, there needs to be a fix. And a short-term fix, and we would ask there that the court take action, enter an order, two prongs. And one of those would be to order the Court of Appeals to decide these cases as expeditiously as possible. I mean, this court has that authority. It has both statutory, constitutional, inherent, implied, sweeping authority to administer justice and make sure that it is delivered promptly. And so we ask you to order the Court of Appeals to do this as expeditiously as possible.
Does that need to have a little more meat on the bones, though? Because in this case, it was 10 months since briefing was completed that the Court of Appeals issued a decision. This is sort of a question for everybody. I don't know why it took that long for a case like this. I don't think it should have. Does anyone have any insight into why it would take the Court of Appeals that long to issue a decision?
You know, I don't want to speak for the Court of Appeals, and I actually don't want them speaking for the public defender either. But I possibly that is because of you know, when you look at, that's just how long one judge opinions take. When you look at the Court of Appeals statistics, it wasn't out of line with that. And so thank you, Justice Bradley. I do think you could put more meat on the bones. And in TPR appeals, for example, the Court of Appeals has to decide them within 30 days. And in the interim, we could say, hey, let's get these done in 30 days. And I recognize that there's going to be situations where the court can't do that. I mean, just look at this case. Attorney Rich had a family member who died in the course of the case. Corp counsel needed an extension. We, the public defender, had a terrible time finding lawyers to take the case. So there's going to be situations where they're not going to make it while the underlying order is still in effect. So that's the second thing that we request. That is, direct the Court of Appeals to decide, or let me phrase this well, appropriately. Don't dismiss these cases solely because the underlying order has expired. Now, could there be some other reason why one of these cases is moot? Maybe. And in that event, then the county can raise it and we can have a discussion on it. But we're focused on the fact that 80930's interaction, you know, with the right to appeal is wreaking havoc with our client's right to appeal.
Would your latter request, though, affect the substantive rights of the parties, or at least the subject matter of the commitment proceeding? Because then we can't tread there, according to statute.
I don't understand, Your Honor.
I don't have the statute. Oh, I do have it right in front of me. 751.12. I think it's sub one. We have limits on our ability to make changes to pleading practice and procedure if it affects the substantive rights of a party. So that was my question. If it's better answered by others, that's fine.
I don't think it does. I think moving the case along does not affect the substantive rights of the party. I think it's ensuring that the substantive questions will be addressed. That would be the difference there. May I speak for 60 seconds on due process, Your Honor?
Sure.
The points here are very simple, and one of them my colleague brought up, which is, look, at the time that the county's bringing this recommitment petition, they have been treating our clients not maybe for six months or 12 months, maybe for decades. They have to know what they're afraid of if treatment is withdrawn. And conversely, our lawyers don't know that. They are not interacting with these clients during the course of their commitment. Their representation ends when they file the notice of intent. And we can't even guarantee, and we don't guarantee, that they'll have the same lawyer from commitment to commitment. And that's why it's so important that we receive notice up front in the petition as to both the standard of dangerousness and the factual basis for the recommitment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Ames?
May I proceed? May it please the court, my name is Doug Brains. I represent Sauk County. SAM challenges an order for recommitment that expired in February 2019. So as the Court of Appeals correctly concluded, the case is moot, and this court can affirm on that basis. I want to frame the issues briefly. There are four issues here, including one that the court raised. The first issue is whether there is any collateral consequences or exceptions to the mootness doctrine that apply to make this moot case not moot. The answer is no. The second issue, as to the merits, is whether SAM was deemed dangerous in the process. The answer to that question is yes. The third issue relates to sufficiency of the evidence. Was there sufficient evidence to recommit SAM? The answer again is yes, under two separate standards. Both under the third standard and under the third standard in conjunction with the alternative recommitment standard, that's sub 1 a.m. And then the last issue is the one that the court raised on its own accord, and that is, does this court have the authority to expedite appeals in Chapter 51 or otherwise order the Court of Appeals to address the merits in these cases? I want to address the last issue briefly because it goes to the first question that Justice Rogensack asked. I think we all agree that this court does have the authority, either through rulemaking or even through the common law, to expedite appeals in Chapter 51 cases. The trickier question in my mind is whether this court has the authority to order the Court of Appeals to address the merits in all Chapter 51 cases. I don't think that's the case, and it's for the reason that Justice Rebecca Bradley indicated a moment ago. The scope of this court's authority is governed by 751.12, and that statute says that this court cannot take action that will abridge the substantive rights of the litigants. And I can conceive of situations where ordering the Court of Appeals to address the merits in a Chapter 51 case would abridge the substantive rights of the litigants. One of those examples might be where the Court of Appeals does not have subject matter jurisdiction. That would be the case if the notice of appeal was untimely. Another circumstance that would abridge the rights of the parties is if the Court of Appeals does not have personal jurisdiction.
Is that what Attorney Ball just said? I heard something different when she said, don't dismiss solely because the underlying order has expired. And then she went further to say, that doesn't mean that the case wouldn't be dismissed on other basis, but it would mean don't dismiss it solely on that basis. Are you saying the same thing, or are you...
I'm not sure. What I'm trying to discern is the issue that the court raised. And as I understand the issue as the court raised it, the court is asking the question of whether this panel has the ability to order the Court of Appeals to address the merits of Chapter 51 cases. And I think generally the court does, but the court cannot overstep the text of 751.12, which says that this court does not have the authority to abridge the substantive rights of the litigants.
Or even enlarge or modify them. That's what I'm concerned about, because it could be the situation. I'm sorry if I interrupted your line.
I was listening to your question.
I don't know if it would be enlarging or modifying the substantive rights of the subject of the commitment proceeding to order the Court of Appeals to decide cases on the merits, to reach the merits, regardless of what arguments might be made against the court.
I agree, but not in all cases. And that's the point that I'm trying to raise a point of caution for this court. To carte blanche say that the Court of Appeals has the ability to decide Chapter 51 cases in all cases potentially could lead to the abridgment of the substantive rights of the parties.
Well, if we go back to the way Justice Ziegler phrased it, because they're phrasing it differently, isn't that the key? I mean, I hear what you're saying, and you're right. If we phrased it as carte blanche as that, there could be a problem.
Yes.
Well, Justice Ziegler asked it differently than Justice Rebecca Bradley, and the way that Attorney Ball phrased it, it's not ordering them to decide the merits. What if we said not to dismiss it solely because the underlying order expired? And then if there's another reason to dismiss it, it can be dismissed. That wouldn't be affecting rights then, would we?
I don't think so. I mean, it's hard to say in the abstract that you wouldn't be affecting rights in every circumstance. But as Your Honor is positing it, it sounds like you would not be abridging the rights.
Counsel, I'd like to ask about collateral consequences.
Yes.
And I want to talk about the treatment costs. The statute, 4610, says that basically any person who receives care from an institution in the state, under 5120, quote, shall be liable for the cost of the care, maintenance, services, and supplies. In accordance with the fee schedule, the department needs to make efforts to notify, but that does not, that receipt of that notice is not a condition of liability. And if you go to subsection 4, it talks about if a person liable under sub 2 fails to make a payment, yada, yada, yada. In other words, I guess I'm trying to understand why the statute basically says you are liable for the cost of your care. It just says that. It doesn't condition it on anything. Now, whether they pay or not might be a different question. Whether there's an enforcement proceeding brought is a different question. The statute makes someone statutorily liable for the cost of their care. How is that not an independent live controversy that would overcome the sort of default mootness? If this is a collateral consequence that seems pretty apparent from the statutory language.
As I understand that statute, and as I understand the case law of this court interpreting that statute, someone is liable for the cost of their care only to the extent that they are able to pay.
Well, they may be paying, but the statute actually says shall be liable. So whether you pay or not, I mean, whether you actually end up being required to pay the money is a different question as to whether you're liable for it. I mean, you know, if there's a judgment against me, I may or may not be able to pay that judgment. I may not ever pay a penny. Nobody ever may try to enforce the judgment against me. But that doesn't mean there hasn't been a financial judgment against me. And it, at least as I'm reading the black and white language of the statute, it sure seems to make financial liability a truism for everybody who has care in an institution.
I don't read the statute that way, nor do I read this court's case law that way.
Could you point me to where in the statute you see any conditions upon liability in terms of actual liability? 4610, yes. Your response in your briefing was that, it does not show he's actually liable for care, except or that he's incurred any liability. And again, maybe I'm missing it, and again, I'm happy to be corrected, but the statute just says shall be liable if you receive care on the state. You owe it, whether you pay or not.
I'm not seeing it immediately, Justice Hagedorn, and I don't recall the case offhand. I think it's DK, though. Or perhaps it's JWK, where this court interprets that statute to say that someone is liable for their cost of care only to the extent that they are able to pay. And I think that that is a limitation on presuming that cost of care would be a collateral consequence in every case. It would be a collateral consequence only in those situations where a person is actually liable for the cost of the care. That's what the Court of Appeals determined in this case correctly, because SAM has not actually shown that he was liable for the cost of his care in this case.
So somebody becomes liable when, what, they have enough money, is that what you're saying, to pay the cost of their care? Like what are you saying? When are you saying liability attaches?
when they are able to pay. That's what the legislature's judgment is, as I read that statute and as I understand the case law.
So do you have evidence that SAM is – so do you have – I mean, how does the burden work in this situation? Like somebody who has care, at what point – who makes the determination and when would you say they're able to pay?
The burden is on the person who is subject to a Chapter 51 commitment to show that there are collateral consequences. It's not the burden on the county to show that there are no collateral consequences. SAM is asserting that liability for the cost of his care was a collateral consequence in this case. The Court of Appeals disagreed, and I think rightly so, because the Court of Appeals, interpreting the statute and interpreting the case law that interprets that statute, said that there was no showing on SAM's part that he is actually liable for the cost of his care. Now, I'm not entirely sure what that means. I'm not sure what the legislature might be contemplating by to the extent that that person is able to pay.
That language
but nonetheless,
isn't in the statute.
I beg your pardon, Justice Hagedorn.
I'm sorry. I was saying that language is, at least I'm not seeing it in the statute. And again, the statute just says shall be liable. And then you pay it according to a fee schedule. Maybe some of that's where it plays out, but I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish your thought, sir.
No, thank you. I did want to address collateral consequences because there are three of them being asserted here.
Counsel?
Yes.
Before you do that, if you could address what Attorney Ball indicated regarding notice.
Yes.
At the conclusion of her comment, she said, at the time the county, bring recommitment, the county has to know. In other words, they have had this person subject to that jurisdiction for a long, substantial period of time. And what she is asking is that the county give notice of the standard of dangerousness and the factual basis for recommitment. She then indicated also that oftentimes the attorney representing the committee is new to the case, short time, and that there cannot be adequate representation without this kind of notice. Can you respond to the request that the county indicate the standard of dangerousness upon which it is proceeding in a factual basis for the recommitment?
Yes, I have a three-part response to that. Number one, there's no statute and no case that obligates a county to give advance notice of the statutory standard of dangerousness that it intends to prove.
Yeah, the argument
in fact,
is essentially one of fundamental fairness.
I beg your pardon?
The argument is essentially one of fundamental fairness, due process.
I understand that, but it's an argument that the Court of Appeals has rejected on a number of occasions, most recently in the Trumbull County versus BK case that was decided in July of last year. And we have to remember, too, this is the second point, that this is a recommitment, and SLL is the case that governs the notice that is required in a petition for recommitment. And SLL says a notice for recommitment needs four data points to comply with due process. Number one, the date. Number two, the time. Number three, the location. And number four, the subject matter of the recommitment hearing. Sauk County satisfied that standard. The third point that I want to make is it's not a mystery because by statute, counties are obligated to provide 48 hours in advance of the final hearing, they're obligated to provide access to all reports. So if someone who is committed under Chapter 51 wants to avail himself of the information in possession of the county, all they have to do is invoke that statute.
So did you, just responding to that response, I think Attorney Rich gave some examples of how challenging that can be for attorneys representing these individuals in that, first of all, it's only 48 hours before, and second of all, they're left trying to guess which witnesses to call. So how is this somehow burdensome to you, the county, to just give them notice of what, and if it's more than one section, then you put both sections down with the factual basis for both. How is that something that's
It's often done. In fact, it was done in this case.
So what's the problem with us saying it should be done in every case?
Because, well, again, we're going back to SLL. We have to remember that this is a recommitment case. And SLL identifies with the content of a recommitment that satisfies due process.
Okay, and we can change that, right? We're the Supreme Court. So what's the reason why we shouldn't be? We shouldn't do that. Tell me a reason that affects you, the county, not based on our prior case law.
Well, that's a fair point. I mean, I think we both agree if the court is going to require counties to put in a petition for recommitment or a petition for initial commitment the specific statutory standard of dangerousness they intend to prove, then we're talking about this court overruling SLL. I'm not sure that the counties would be particularly burdened because, again, they're obligated to provide advance notice or at least 48 hours in advance access of reports. But it's often the case, and like I was saying, it was the case here, where the specific statutory standards of dangerousness were identified in advance of the initial commitment hearing. So, for instance, Dr. Bales's report, which is record 10, identified three standards of dangerousness that he believed were satisfied based on his examination of SAM.
Right, but how does so he identifies three. What if the county's only proceeding on one? Or what if, I mean, so again, is it, I understand the argument to be to ask the county to allege those standards, not just for the person who's potentially being committed to try to figure out which standard the state's going to pick under all
this. In that circumstance, if we're talking about an initial commitment, the county might not know what standard actually applies until they receive the report from the doctor. So the petition for commitment predates the physician report.
And that's fair. In that circumstance,
it is very burdensome.
What about recommitment? Where are we at here?
Back to recommitment, we're back to SLL then. And then the court needs to look at whether it wants to overrule SLL.
Well, hang on a minute, counsel, because SLL, unlike our mootness doctrine, was not based on judicial policy. It was based on the statutory requirements. So in response to Justice Dowlett, I understand your response seems to be, well, we could do that because we're the Supreme Court, but wouldn't we be tacking on requirements that do not exist in the statute?
As interpreted by SLL, I would agree, yes. I did want to address back to the collateral consequences that are being asserted here. We talked about the liability of cost of care. There are two others being asserted. One of them is the firearms ban, and the other one is social stigma. The firearms ban is not a collateral consequence in this case because, again, we're talking about a recommitment. Firearms ban was imposed in conjunction with the initial commitment order, and that order says that the firearms ban survives expiration of that order. So the recommitment order has no effect on the firearms ban. If this court were to vacate, for example, the recommitment order, the firearms ban would still be in place, and thus, by definition, it is not a collateral consequence. The Court of Appeals determined that, and I think the Court of Appeals was correct on that count.
Let me just ask one question about that. It's just, we've obviously had a number of these questions that have come, and I understand that the firearms ban comes with the initial order. But the recommitment also is a separate, independent ban on its own. It's not just an extension of the original ban. It's actually a separate one. And my understanding of the statutory scheme is that there would need to be a petition to remove that ban, and there's some considerations based upon the circumstances and how they've changed from the time of that determination till the present time. Now, maybe as a practical matter, it wouldn't make a lot of difference. But theoretically, a recommitment in, 2018 versus an original commitment in 2008 might have some different circumstances. And theoretically, the circuit court would be taking into account all those things. So you'd have a whole bunch of separate bans functionally, right?
Right.
But the recommitment is not just an extension. It's actually a separate firearms ban all by itself that stands on its own. It duplicates another ban. But how would you respond to that?
Yeah, it duplicates it and therefore doesn't have really any effect. I take Your Honor's point that it is a separate ban. I can't quarrel with that. But the effect on the firearms ban is negligible, because if you vacate the recommitment order, the firearms ban remains in place.
Yeah, but let me just push back a little bit on that. Imagine I, had a judgment against me for $500. Then you get a separate judgment for that same $500. That doesn't mean I don't have two separate judgments, each with their own effect, even though one of them in practice may not have much practical effect. You still have a separate court order that means something. And with every recommitment, you have a separate court order that prohibits someone from owning a firearm.
And the question here is, does that separate order, does it constitute a collateral consequence? While I agree with you that it is a separate order and therefore must have some meaning because of that, the question is it a collateral consequence? And because it doesn't have any effect on the firearms ban one way or the other, it is not a collateral consequence in this type of circumstance. Let me address stigma briefly, too. As far as I'm aware, stigma has never been held by this court or any court in Wisconsin to be a of involuntary commitment. And SAM hasn't shown that he has incurred any stigma in this case. And I would submit if there's any stigma associated with involuntary commitment, it naturally would attach at the initial commitment. And SAM hasn't shown that he has incurred any different or additional stigma as a result of the recommitment. I want to address briefly the sufficiency of the evidence challenge, because we haven't addressed that yet. I indicated at the outset that the evidence here satisfies the third standard, also the third standard in conjunction with the alternative recommitment standard. The reason that the third standard is met, well, let me tell you what the third standard is first. Under the third standard, someone is dangerous if there's a substantial probability that that person will harm himself. In this case, there wasn't just a substantial probability that SAM would harm himself. He, in fact, harmed himself. That's undisputed. That alone satisfies the third standard. But the alternative recommitment standard is also satisfied. In conjunction with the notice of recommitment, there was a report filed by Dr. DiRamondo, and she indicated in that report that if treatment were withdrawn, SAM would be a proper subject to commitment because in the past he had stopped taking his medication and regressed to an acute psychotic state that required hospitalization. Her language in that report, if treatment were withdrawn, he'd become a proper subject to commitment, mirrors the alternative recommitment standard language. So if you tie those two things together, we have the third standard separately satisfied, and we have the third standard in conjunction with the alternative recommitment standard.
Your briefing seemed to separate those two as independent, and I don't think that, well, that's not correct.
I agree with you. I thought my briefing was more clear until I received counsel's reply brief, and then it became apparent to me that I wasn't as clear in that regard as I had hoped. So, yes, I agree with you that if you're going to rely on the alternative recommitment standard, you have to also rely, in addition, on one of the five statutory standards of dangerousness. So my apologies to the court for not making that as clear as I could have. I want to address briefly a comment by counsel about Wisconsin overcommitting. I disagree with that. The purpose of Chapter 51, it's a treatment statute. It's not a punitive statute. And the purpose of Chapter 51 is to make sure that mentally ill are receiving the treatment they need. And the other purpose is to protect the public. And I think Wisconsin is fulfilling that purpose. There was a report, this isn't in the record, but I think it can be cited. The Treatment Advocacy Center issued this report in September 2020, and it evaluated all 50 states in the union.
Counsel, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Did you say it is or isn't in the record?
It is not in the record, but it's a report that's a public report. I found it on the internet. I think it's citable. It surveyed all 50 states in the union on their ability to provide timely and effective treatment to the mentally ill. And it gave four states an A grade on those criteria. And Wisconsin was one of the four states. So I simply disagree with the notion that Wisconsin is not fulfilling the statutory purpose of Chapter 51. I think I have fairly covered everything that I intended to. If there are no further questions from the panel, I would simply request that the court affirm the Court of Appeals.
I have a little something I wanted to ask you about. We talked initially when opposing counsel first got up about what the court might do in regard to trying to move things along. Do you know whether the county takes a position on the court's actions in regard to having commitments and recommitment matters heard within a short period of time at the Court of Appeals?
Yeah, I agree that the court has the authority to do that. Mm-hmm. Maybe a prudent choice. One of the cautions that I put forth in my brief was, it seems to me that perhaps the more prudent choice would be for the court to engage in that through rulemaking rather than through the common law.
So that we would get input from all different points.
Absolutely.
Of view.
Yeah. Judges, practitioners, experts, people right. other than me who know better would be able to tell the court and give better guidance to the court.
Right. I think the counties, they have a financial responsibility in regard to a responsibility under the statute to provide care. So, okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
May I please record? I had somewhat of an organized order to my rebuttal, but I have to jump right on some of Attorney Rainey's final remarks, which to me I think are typical of a lot of the judges, the trial judges I come before in commitment cases, but which are absolutely not the law. So parens patrie is not the law. That is not, we are well-meaning, and we want to help people who appear to not fit into that narrow corridor of normal. We want to fix them and put them back in there, but that's not the law. We have to show real dangerousness. And the Treatment Advocacy Center, getting an A from the Treatment Advocacy Center means that you are a full-blown advocate of parens patrie. That's what that means. They are all about medicating and confining, and they have documentaries out, and they are not somebody who advocates for civil liberties at all. On the issue of stigma, it's certainly undeniable that it exists and causes harm and trauma to the people that we subject to involuntary confinement. The county has argued that Sam didn't present any evidence of any of the collateral consequences he alleges and that they affected him. And as I said in the reply, the problem with that is he cannot do so. There are three issues in an involuntary commitment case: mentally ill, treatable, and dangerous. And if I'm trial counsel and I try to talk about specific ways that my clients experience stigma or specific collateral specific financial consequences, or how he's Native American and enjoys hunting on the reservation with his friends and now he can't, that's all irrelevant and none of it will get in. So we can't do that. That can't be the standard. And that's why Sibrin, cited with approval in DK, says we're not going to make you prove them. They are presumed to exist.
What do you think would happen if you made a motion for a more definite statement or motion to clarify the pleadings in these cases? I know that's one more thing to file, but if you really were unclear,
about how the county was proceeding and on what basis they were proceeding. That's sometimes something I've seen in a civil case.
Right. That, it could be done that way. It could be done potentially as a motion to supplement the record. I don't know if it'd be allowed or not. But, yeah, you could come back into court on a motion, potentially gather additional testimony. If I were the trial judge, I'd be tempted to say this isn't relevant.
I don't understand that this isn't relevant. Are you finished?
Because there's only three issues. There's only three issues to be proven at the involuntary commitment hearing. Is the respondent mentally ill? Is the mental illness treatable? Is the respondent dangerous? All the other stuff is really not relevant.
But what I thought I heard was that sometimes you don't know which of the five bases they're going to proceed on, and if you knew, you would call different witnesses or address the issue differently. And with that clarification and with that requirement, then you would know how better to proceed.
I see that as a different issue because that is talking specifically about one of those three elements, dangerousness. And there's five, maybe six ways to prove dangerousness. Okay. So that's relevant because that has to do with proving dangerousness, which is one of the elements. But I don't see financial consequences as fitting within that.
Pleading in practice comes within our purview under, 751.12. Yeah,
okay.
751.12. Thank you. It seems like under due process rationale, but it seems like Attorney Ball is asking that henceforth, and this takes off the question that you were just asked earlier, that the pleading then give notice to the respondent, the county's pleading, what dangerousness is being alleged and the factual basis for that. Do you anticipate any kind of problem with that? I mean, I should have asked more particularly your opposing counsel because you're probably in accord with that. But any comment to save me from an embarrassing moment?
I think, I do not see that how 751.12 would create that problem. I also believe you've got your authority under Article 7, Section 3, that the court raised. And you did some things under that authority throughout the pandemic. I think you have the authority to do it.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for your good briefs and arguments. Justice Dalich will be out here to talk to the group in a few minutes. In the meantime, I think you have a warm-up panel. We have Judge Koshnick, who came up and wants to have a few minutes of your time for the students who are here in class, so that gives you to breathe as well. All right. Nice to see you, Judge Koshnick.
Nice to see you,